Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 457, titled Three's a Crowd, Terrorism in the Triple Border Area. This is being recorded on April 25th of the year 2004. Remember that there'll be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 457 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. I often include information in the description that I didn't have time to put in the original broadcast, so please do not neglect the descriptions. There's a page to click on at the beginning of each description for people who would like to support the work that I'm doing. The Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com is now equipped with a search function so listeners can locate a particular item within the descriptions. Also be aware that the vitally important text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, essential for an understanding of these broadcasts, is now available for download for free on the Spitfire website. That text by the late heroic Paul Manning is, again, very important for an understanding not only of these broadcasts, but of the events that are overtaking the world. And in particular, when I talk about the Underground Reich, I can appreciate that that's something that might make people think that I have a D blank, blank, blank growing out of my head. But no, in fact, sadly, it's true. And that text will help you to understand that. You can now get it for free on the Spitfire website. The only investment will be time, and if you want to print it, paper, okay? The heroic WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older For the Record programs are available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. So when I make references to other broadcasts, thanks to WFMU, you can listen to all of them on Real Audio on the Internet any time of the day or night. Now, we're going to proceed with the discussion of the Triple Border Area, an area where there has been, among other things, networking between various terrorist groups, Shia and Sunni Islamist terrorists, white supremacist terrorists from the United States, Aryan Nation, and so-called neo-Nazis in particular, and also terrorists from other parts of Europe as well. It's important to note that one of the economic underpinnings of this particular area is organized crime and funny money. There's a lot of trafficking in contraband, black market goods, drugs, money laundering, weapons, things of that kind. And next week, by the way, we're going to be visiting with the remarkable Lucy Commissar, and we're going to be talking about offshore tax havens and the role that those play in modern political and economic life. And once again, with regard to the offshore tax havens, as is the case with the Triple Border area that we're talking about now, the link between the overworld and the underworld, between the more prestigious elements of politics and business and underground elements associated with, at least in most people's minds, exclusively with a criminal network, those elements merge, and organized crime, the trafficking in contraband, the evasion of taxes, all of them have their intersection with the world of terrorism in these offshore tax havens, and we're going to be talking about that next week. Now, the Triple Border area, in which we're going to be examining a number of different elements in this side of the broadcast, began to be developed when Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay, the three countries whose borders converge in this area, decided to try to develop this area as sort of a combination of Niagara Falls, Las Vegas, and Miami, areas where tourism and other things would be combined in order to produce a boom area. It didn't actually work that way, but it did set the stage for a large, to a certain extent, underground community in which, again, the links between the overworld and the underworld are blurred, and this underground economy has served in many ways as the manure in which this terrorist milieu has thrived. Turning once again to the article that is the basis for this broadcast, this is Terrorism's New Geography by the remarkable Sebastian Junger. This is from Vanity Fair's issue of December of 2002, and a tip of the hat to a member of the listening audience who researched this for us. Now, of Argentina, Brazil, and Paraguay's development of the Triple Border area and how this spawned the strange political and economic bedfellows who were the focal point of this broadcast, we read, A zone of special tourism, unquote, was established where Brazilians and Argentinians, for the most part, could converge on the Paraguayan boomtown of Ciudad del Este, mainly to buy cheap electronics. Now, high-rises jut improbably out of the jungle. An estimated $12 to $14 billion in merchandise moves to Ciudad del Este every year. It's a place, according to Lima, where a young Lebanese man can arrive with nothing but a suitcase and be driving a late-model Mercedes within a year. The Central Bank of Brazil created a special account called the CC5, ostensibly for foreigners, which allowed Paraguayan money to be more cheaply and quickly converted to dollars and deposited the same day in local banks on the Brazilian side. Traffickers quickly discovered that to launder their profits, all they had to do was to take their money to Ciudad del Este and transfer it back to Brazil, often opening fake accounts in the name of their housemaid or gardener in order to throw off any possible investigators. Triple Border is now a thriving nexus of drugs, weapons, and money laundering operations. An estimated 70% of the cars on Paraguay's roads, there are even rumors about the BMW and the Mercedes owned by President Luis González Maqui and his wife, have been smuggled in to avoid the heavy import taxes. The International Intellectual Property Alliance estimates that Ciudad del Este's booming trade in pirated CDs contributed to a loss of $300 million in sales for the Brazilian music industry in 2000 alone. A stolen or forged passport costs $5,000 on the street, and a customs official can reportedly be bribed for a tenth of that. The Paraguayan consul in Miami was recently arrested for allegedly selling a batch of 300 passports to foreigners, including to terrorist suspects from the Middle East who planned to move to Ciudad del Este. Hezbollah and Hamas cells easily integrated themselves into this tightly knit Muslim community. Not only is it an ideal place to blend in, but a huge amount of money is funneled back to Lebanon to support the cause. Bank records show that a Lebanese businessman named Assad Ahmed Mohammed Barakat, who owns one of the largest shopping malls in Ciudad del Este, has transferred thousands of dollars to Hezbollah over the years. A month after the September 11th attacks, Paraguayan police, under intense pressure from the United States, swept Ciudad del Este and arrested a dozen or so suspected money launderers. Barakat himself managed to escape the raid, but in his office the police found scores of copies of an Al-Qaeda promotional video. He had been making them, apparently, to distribute to extremists in Triple Border. Carlos Calcena, the Paraguayan prosecutor in charge of the case, has tracked tens of thousands of dollars in money transfers from the port town of Iquique, Chile, to Ciudad del Este to a Chase Manhattan bank account in the name of, quote, Mr. Barakat, unquote, in Long Island City, New York. Barakat was eventually arrested in Brazil last summer, but his financial empire is enormous and relatively intact at this point. The Bank of England financial sanctions related to terrorism list includes 28 entries under the name Barakat or Al-Barakat, including companies in Boston, Minneapolis, and Seattle. It's unknown how many belong to the same family. There was even a Barakat trading company in the Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul before the Taliban fell. Since the September 11th attacks, the United States has sent a team of 40 FBI agents to Ciudad del Este to help local authorities tackle the terrorism and money problem, but it may be too late. According to Calcena, as much as $50 million is believed to have flowed from Triple Border to Hezbollah accounts in the past 7 years alone. It is enough to finance almost any kind of attack or cover-up imaginable. Now, as I mentioned in Side 1, there were at least two separate warnings of the events that were to unfold on September 11th from the Triple Border area in advance of the attacks. One of these was from a young Moroccan who was a recruit for some of the Islamist terrorists in this area, but who was appalled by the level of violence and rolled over to no ultimate effect. Continuing with Sebastian Junger's article, if there was any doubt among U.S. officials before September 11th that Triple Border was a haven for Al-Qaeda, it should have been erased by the case of a young Moroccan named Gaydan Abdel Fattah. In January of 2001, Fattah was detained for allegedly having a false passport in São Paulo after trying to rob a taxi. 8 months later, just days prior to September 11th, Fatah handed a typed letter to attorney Edith Espinosa at the prison where he was incarcerated and begged her to give it to the federal police in Brazil in the presence of U.S. Embassy and Israeli diplomatic officials. In the letter, Fatah said that he urgently needed to talk with the authorities because there were going to be, quote, two explosions, unquote, in the United States in the near future. The lawyer neglected to pass the letter along, and 6 days later, al-Qaeda agents flew planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Just hours after the attack, São Paulo Police Commissioner Cesar Toselli went to the Curandiro prison to interrogate Fatah. The young Moroccan had a chilling story to tell. He said he had gone to Triple Border the year before, and for several months attended meetings at a mosque in Foz do Iguaçu where Shiite and Sunni Muslims, ordinarily enemies, talked openly about, quote, blowing up, unquote, the United States. Fatah said he maintained contact with 8 foreigners from these meetings, including 4 Pakistanis, a Costa Rican, and an Indian. The Indian supposedly had coded phone conversations from a payphone with someone in the United States. Disillusioned and frightened by the violence of their plans, Fatah said he fled the area and contacted the American and Israeli embassies in Brazil and the American consulate in Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro to warn them. He was ignored. Out of money and desperate, he allegedly tried to rob a taxi for plane fare home and was caught. He remained in prison as a privileged informer, under police protection. Fatah's story jibes with what is already known about Triple Border. Saeed Mokales, alleged mastermind of the 1997 massacre in Luxor, Egypt, in which 58 Western tourists were killed in a machine gun attack while they admired an ancient temple, lived quietly in Triple Border for years. He was arrested in January of 1999 by Uruguayan police after British intelligence picked up coded phone conversations in which he discussed starting a terrorist cell in London. Mokles was alleged to have received help from Mohamed Kassem Joma, the mayor of Chuí, a small town in Brazil. Joma was questioned by authorities after the September 11th attacks because of his association with Mokles, as well as for suspected ties to Osama bin Laden. And Imad Mugunaya, the Hezbollah foreign operations chief who might rival Osama bin Laden as the most wanted man in the world, has been indicted in Argentina for organizing the AMIA and Israeli embassy attacks. Mugunaya has a $25 million bounty on his head for a long list of terrorist attacks, including the 1983 Marine barracks and U.S. embassy bombings in Lebanon. The association between bin Laden and Mugunaya dates back to the early 1990s when a former American Green Beret named Ali Mohammed, who recently pleaded guilty to conspiring with al-Qaeda to bomb U.S. embassies in Africa, arranged security for the two men when they met in Sudan. Mugunaya's alleged use of bomb attacks to drive American forces out of Beirut in the 1980s was likely a model for bin Laden's attempts to drive American forces from Saudi Arabia. 3 years after the Sudan meeting, a terrorist group thought to be associated with bin Laden detonated a truck bomb at the Khobar Towers complex near a U.S. military base in Saudi Arabia, killing 19 servicemen. Mugunaya was implicated by U.S. authorities in that attack. He has also been implicated in carrying out or directing at least 3 hijackings, including that of an Air India flight in which terrorists armed with knives and scissors took over the cockpit and successfully landed the plane on their own. They knifed a passenger and forced others to watch him bleed to death, presumably to encourage cooperation. The same tactic was used by Atta and the other hijackers on September 11th. I met Mario Aguiar Risi in the lobby of the Buenos Aires Sheraton on an afternoon last September. He was short and well-dressed in a suit and tie and had deep circles under his eyes and an exhausted basset hound expression that suggested an enormously stressful life. His beard, stained by cigarette smoke above the mouth, had turned mostly white and his hair was thin. He talked fast and almost without pause, slowing only to draw out the names of terrorists, Mugunaya, bin al-Shib, for instance, and he apparently could talk about terrorism non-stop for hours. He said he was a former Argentinian intelligence officer who had worked in counter-espionage, counter-insurgency, and criminal investigations. He claimed he had also worked along with 30 or so other Argentinian agents for the CIA on the Nicaraguan border, training the Contras to infiltrate and destabilize the Sandinista government in the 1980s. He served in intelligence in the Falklands War, called the Malvinas War in Argentina, and several years later was chosen by Argentinian President Raúl Alfonsín to investigate the 1985 kidnapping of a Jewish businessman named Osvaldo Sivak. It was the Sivak affair that got him into trouble, he said. Through his covert sources, he found out that Sivak was dead, but the political climate was too unstable for the government to admit that. When Sivak's family lent the investigation a large sum of money, several top government ministers, knowing Sivak was dead, simply divided the money up among themselves. Risi accepted some of the money as well. Quote, frankly, it came in useful, unquote, he said, and then took the fall for the crime, even being charged with the kidnapping itself. He was eventually released from jail, and others were charged with the crime. Risi had stories to tell about Triple Border as well. His partner, Alejandro, he said, succeeded in infiltrating the world of terrorist cells and was trained at one of their camps on the Brazilian-Paraguayan border. There, they used cutouts of American soldiers and Jews, unquote, for target practice. Alejandro was now a foot soldier in a Hezbollah Al-Qaeda cell, Risi said, and was used to provide security whenever a really big name came to town. In 1998, according to Alejandro, two imams from African countries had come to help plan the U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. Risi said he contacted the U.S. authorities in Buenos Aires to warn them, but he was ignored. 2 months later, truck bombs destroyed both embassies, killing 224 people. Risi came prepared for the meeting with a locking briefcase filled with documents and photographs. Shuffling through material as he talked, he pulled out letters that he claimed to have submitted to Argentinian and American authorities over the years. They were written in a painfully precise script, and some are stamped at the bottom with the date and AM Embassy or Embassy of the United States, unquote. One, dated February 2001, but not bearing an embassy stamp, purports to warn American Ambassador James Walsh of the upcoming attacks on September 11th. Mr. Ambassador, the letter begins, as a citizen of Argentina, I, Mario Aguilar, am writing you to make you aware of very serious and urgent information. Within the next 6 months, there will be 4 large-scale attacks in the United States by Al-Qaeda, unquote. In the letter, Risi listed the White House, Congress, the Pentagon, and the Twin Towers as possible targets for planes loaded with explosives flown by suicide pilots. I can expand on this, he finishes, if this is of interest to your government. I am at your disposal as an uninterested party, unquote. And he had photos, dozens of them. One showed a man known as Akma as Ahad in front of some street vendors in Ciudad del Este. Ahad, Risi said, is wanted in connection with the AMIA bombing and is thought to be connected to Al-Qaeda. The photo was supposedly taken by a camera hidden in a shoebox. Another photo showed a man Risi described as a Hezbollah agent named Saeed walking down a street in Ciudad del Este. According to Risi, Saeed is closely associated with Mugunaya as well as Al-Qaeda and served as an instructor at one of its training camps. There were photos of what Risi says are Al-Qaeda bodyguards with machine guns of Al-Qaeda safe houses, of illegal businesses owned by Hezbollah agents. There was even a photo of a CIA informant in Foz do Iguaçu. Do you know who this man is also working for? Risi asked in disgust. Hezbollah. And who do you think pays him more? Unquote. Triple Border, Risi said, was a major logistical and planning base for Al-Qaeda, a place where its members could get money, fake passports, and easy access to every country in South America. It was also a place where they could relax. They could drink, they could have girls, they could do whatever they wanted without some scowling imam looking over their shoulder. The terrorists weren't just radical Islamists, either. They were from the Irish Republican Army, the Basque Separatist Group ETA, and Colombia's FARC. According to Risi, a cousin of the Lebanese businessman Barakat, now in prison in Brazil, was the main Al-Qaeda contact in Spain. A Spaniard, whose name won't be divulged here so as not to hinder counterterrorism efforts, was ETA's contact in Triple Border, and had trained Alejandro in one of the camps. By the way, parenthetically, I would add, in the recent March bombings in Madrid, those immediately prior to the Spanish elections, there was some initial attribution of those attacks to ETA terrorists, and when in fact it became clear that these were Islamist terrorists with at least some links to Al-Qaeda, it served to affect the Spanish elections, and eventually President Aznar was voted out of office. Among the factors to consider here is the possibility that there may have been some deliberate fudging on the part of the perpetrators of some of these overlapping terrorist networks within the Triple Border area, and apparently from there branching out to other places, including Spain. Again, an interesting item to ponder in that regard. Now, as we looked at last week, among the elements that is apparently networking with Islamist terrorists and Al-Qaeda in the Triple Border area are American white supremacist and neo-Nazi terrorist elements, this networking apparently going back to the mid-1980s, including, according to Risi, allegedly, a former Green Beret with combat experience in Vietnam who actually provided logistical support to Mohammed Atta in the United States before the attacks. In a number of broadcasts, including For the Record programs 443 and 447, we looked at a number of interesting allegations concerning links between people involved in the first World Trade Center attack in 1993, like Ramzi Youssef, and people involved with the Oklahoma City bombing, such as Terry Nichols and Timothy McVeigh. We also took a look at accounts coming out of the Oklahoma City area of a particular motel, which was allegedly a rendezvous point not only for some of the September 11th hijackers, but also for Timothy McVeigh networking with unidentified Middle Eastern men in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing as well. With some of these accounts linking Islamist terrorists with American white supremacist and neo-Nazi terrorists coming out of areas as disparate as the tri-border area, Oklahoma City, and the Philippines, and with the extraordinarily unlikely possibility, with it being extremely unlikely that there's some sort of weird A-blank-blank conspiracy between people in the tri-border area in Latin America, Oklahoma City, and the Philippines to develop some sort of bogus conspiratorial link between Islamists and white supremacists, I think that these are allegations that need to be very, very seriously considered and investigated by law enforcement and intelligence. Continuing with Sebastian Junger's account of American white supremacists and neo-Nazi networking with these same Islamist terrorists in the tri-border area, we read, "And there were Americans at the camp as well. Risi learned about one of them, and on January 12, 1996, he says, he took a polygraph test and made a statement to the federal court in Buenos Aires testifying to everything he knew about this American. The man, whose name also won't be divulged, is an ex-Special Forces soldier who had been a communications expert in Vietnam and had seen combat there. He returned home to join the Michigan militia, then converted to Islam, worked in Jordan, and became associated with another American who had been investigated by the DEA for activities in Central America. Now, according to Risi, the Vietnam vet who speaks Spanish is in Triple Border with two other American extremists, acting as an instructor at one of the terrorist training camps. He is also responsible for security operations and provided armed guards when top Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah associates, in particular Muganaya, were in town. According to Risi, the man had also been in the United States on September 11th and had provided logistical support to Mohammed Atta before the attacks. I was prepared to believe everything Risi said about Triple Border, but when it came to an American collaborator on September 11th, I balked. Quote, why would an American attack his own country? I asked. Risi countered with a question of his own. And McVeigh? Unquote. The lack of public discourse about collaboration between white supremacists and Islamic extremists may simply be due to the fact that it is almost too alarming to contemplate. Everything that Arabs now have a hard time doing in this country, going to flight school, buying weapons and explosives, driving tractor trailers into Manhattan, could easily be done by a white supremacist from Idaho. For the record, if he drove a tractor trailer carrying 80,000 pounds of high explosives, it could level two square blocks in Manhattan. There is reason to believe that white supremacists see the U.S. government and its Israeli ally as a far greater threat to their freedom than the one posed by Islamic extremists. Shortly after the September 11th attacks, Billy Roper, a former member of the Neo-Nazi National Alliance based in West Virginia, said in an internet posting obtained by the Southern Poverty Law Center, quote, "We may not want them marrying our daughters, just as they would not want us marrying theirs. But anyone who is willing to drive a plane into a building to kill Jews is all right by me. I wish our members had half as much testicular fortitude," unquote. According to Risi, Aryan nations had people in triple border areas as early as 1985, and they were cooperating with Islamic extremists in the United States. Stephen Jones, the chief defense lawyer for Timothy McVeigh, suspects that convicted Kuwaiti terrorist Ramzi Youssef supplied technical expertise in the 1995 Oklahoma City Alfred P. Mura federal building bombing. Even if this particular alliance is not credible or has not yet happened, it would be in keeping with the process of, quote, crossover, unquote, among terrorist groups that is already underway. Skipping down, of Risi's contact Alejandro, who has infiltrated some of the Islamists in the tri-border area, he had been transported to the terrorist world, he said, in a white Mercedes that stopped in front of a bar in Ciudad del Este where he had been told to wait. He was given a pair of blacked-out glasses and driven around for a few hours, asked some questions, including whether he wanted to be paid, to which he said yes, and then dropped off again. A few days later, he went through the same routine, except this time it was in a 4x4, and they drove him out to a training camp. The camp was a clearing in the jungle with a temporary wooden barracks where the men slept on benches and cots. There were 25 or 30 recruits, mostly from other countries in South America. They were trained to break into houses, blow up buildings, disassemble cars for placement of car bombs. They practiced shooting every kind of weapon, Uzis, AK-47s, grenade launchers, and were also taught to kill with a knife. Their training was with live ammunition, and Alejandro was shot twice. He survived, he said, although another man at the camp died of his wounds. "You're trained to kill Americans and Jews," Alejandro said. "At the end, you're given a mission, or you go dormant." The instructors were aloof and unfriendly and did not bother to talk politics or ideology. They just taught how to kill. And again, I think these accounts are to be taken very, very, very seriously. Again, in FTRs 109 and 330, we noted an article from La Nación, the Argentinian paper, AMIA bomb plotters connection, which maintained that some of the Argentinian police officials involved in the or implicated in the AMIA bombing were members of White Aryan Resistance, the American white supremacist organization, with links to some of the people allegedly involved in Oklahoma City, including, by some accounts, Timothy McVeigh himself. And bear in mind that the National Alliance, to which you heard the allusion referring to Billy Roper, is headed up by William Pierce. And repeating an item from FTR 443, we hear about a speech that he made in 1998. In one chilling commentary, Pierce, after noting that bin Laden and the rest of the lost generation of angry Muslim youth had had it with their parents' compromises and were hell-bent on revenge against infidel America, issued this stark prophetic warning in a 1998 radio address titled "Stay Out of Tall Buildings." "New Yorkers who work in tall office buildings anything close to the size of the World Trade Center might consider wearing hard hats," Pierce warned, unquote. That from a Counterpunch article, October 29th of 2001. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 457, Freeze a Crowd, Terrorism in the Triple Border Area, being recorded on April 25th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.